Well, having seen the film, talked about it a bit, you're probably ready to get into the stories and should have some sense of the shape of A Good Man Is Hard to Find. What I want to start with is some commentary by a 12th century mystic named Richard of St. Victor, who wrote about what he called the four stages of violent charity. And he listed them, and I'm doing them in reverse order for a reason. He talked about love, a charity that is forever insatiable, that can never, ever finally be satisfied, charity that is absolute and unique, one of a kind, because each soul is individualized, a charity that binds, that not just binds individual souls together on this earth, but that charity that binds us to God. But the one I want to look at in connection with Flannery O'Connor, he talks about a charity that wounds. That if there is love, and it is real love, and it is real charity, then there are times when it is necessary that that wound. Now, those of us as Catholics should certainly understand that anytime we meditate on the crucifix. In that God the Father gave his Son. The Son willingly allowed himself to suffer on the cross out of love for mankind. So that it should be part of our understanding, although it is not accidental, that now in the 20th century, and you've probably seen these things, there is the vision of the cross with the risen Christ on it. So that we no longer look at that suffering, we no longer look at that pain. I saw this recently at a convent outside of Baltimore. I had never seen one of these things before. It's a very peculiar thing. So that the suffering is gone. What you have is the vision of the resurrection. The cross and the resurrection without the pain, without the suffering. Get rid of that because it makes us uncomfortable. But the fact of the matter is, we know as Catholics that kind of charity, that kind of love, can wound, it can hurt, it can indeed be violent. In order to understand Flannery O'Connor, you need to know one thing, and you need to keep it in mind through every story. O'Connor's vision is simply this. The modern world is so mad, is so separated from God, has closed itself off, has sealed itself off from God's grace to such an extent, has put so many layers of pride between itself and God's grace, that if God's grace is now going to enter a modern soul, it must enter through violence. God must tear away that pride in order to reach the soul. And as a result, in her stories, you often find physical violence occurring because it is an incarnate image, if you will, of God's grace, the love of God coming to man and needing to use violence to get in. Because we've closed the door, we've locked the door, we've barred the door, and we won't let it in. So God comes and rips the door apart. Now, that's what she's giving us. And it's in story after story. And you can almost write an archetypal Flannery O'Connor story where you have the soul filled with pride, smug and content, awash in the modern world, not understanding its own grotesque nature, not understanding that it is misshapen because it is relying on itself and the world, it's relying on materialism and phony sentiment, that it has separated itself from the very source of its being, and then suddenly into the story God's grace intrudes and will come upon an individual soul. And there you have, it's a paradigm, if you will. There is the typical Flannery O'Connor story. It takes different forms, different shapes. She creates different individuals, but that is the sense that we are, that's the sense she gives us. That is what it takes now. And that's why she is an artist writing out of her own time. She knows who we are. She knows how far removed we are from the truth. She knows how closed off and choked and self-reliant and foolish we are. And she knows what it takes. So, I give that as we turn to A Good Man Is Hard to Find. I'm going to break my own little rule, and I'm not going to start with the title. Okay, I'm not going to start with the title. We'll come back to the title. What I want to start with is what I would call the first half of the story, where the story begins. One of the things that is so shocking about this story is it seems almost to be two different stories linked together. We have the comic portion, and then we have this shocking second half. And what she does brilliantly with the comic first half of the story is she gives us a typical American family taking a typical American trip. And there can be no one who has been in a family and gotten in a car and traveled together that will not recognize what's going on here. The details are all there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the details. I'll just say she renders them brilliantly. We all know them. Ah, we'll look at some of them. They're simply wonderful. But I want to go through the first page fairly closely to show you how she's working, because you don't get what comes later unless you have a sense of where we're beginning. The principal character in the story is the grandmother. How do I know that? I look at the first sentence, okay? And not only do we get it announced in the first sentence who the principal character is, we find out something about her right away, and it has to do with her willfulness. The grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. It's a very simple sentence. There it is. We have the principal character announced, and we have that willfulness. I don't want to do what that outside me wishes for me. I don't want to go to Florida. Okay? What becomes clear as the story goes on, if she is saying no to her son, and her son's plans for a trip, the grandmother throughout her life has been saying no to God, I don't want to go to heaven. I'm quite content, thank you. I'm nice, I wear pretty clothes, I say the right things, I'm a good woman, so I don't need any of that. The grandmother didn't want to go to Florida. She wanted to visit some of her connections in East Tennessee, and she was seizing at every chance to change Bailey's mind. It's willfulness, and it is a willfulness that will recreate the world the way I want it to be. Okay? Now, we all know little old ladies. Okay? They are a strong force of nature. They are difficult to deal with. Some of you young seminarians who don't know this yet, talk to some of the priests. You will encounter little old ladies. They are extraordinary creations of God. Okay? When it's grandma, it's even more difficult. It becomes even more difficult. Bailey was the son she lived with, her only boy. She doesn't have to give us the commentary. If you live in this country, you're getting it all. We have the family at home. We have the ideal that we talk about. We have grandma with the son, and he's bringing up the children. We have what should be the ideal family situation. They have not sent grandma to the old folks' home. They haven't put her away in the nursing home. Grandma's there living with the family. That is a very good thing. Yes, right. We're getting the facts as it operates. Grandma is a pain in the neck. Bailey was the son she lived with, her only boy. He was sitting on the edge of the chair at the table, bent over the orange sports section of the journal. In the midst of the hectoring mother, Bailey takes refuge where most American males take refuge, in sports. Okay? But of course, he's not playing sports, he's not listening to sports, he's not even watching sports. He is leaning over the newspaper, he's bent over, and it's orange, which means it's probably reflecting on his face as well. Now look here, Bailey, she said, see here, read this. And she stood with one hand on her thin hip and the other rattling the newspaper at his bald head. Here this fellow that calls himself the misfit is a loose from the federal pen and headed toward Florida. And you read here what it says he did to these people. Just you read it. I wouldn't take my children in any direction with a criminal like that a loose in it. I couldn't answer to my conscience if I did. We begin with the grandmother's will. We end the paragraph with the grandmother referring to her conscience. She's not talking about her conscience. She's still talking about her will. She is trying to bend her son's will to her will, and she will use the misfit, as he's called, the murderer that's out there, just to get her own way. The worst that the world has to offer, and the fact that there are violent criminals loose in it, can be a convenience if you want to get what you want, okay? This will all change by the end of the story, of course. But please notice, and this is magnificent artistry, she is already setting up the confrontation. The grandmother, in the first paragraph, is in charge and has total control over the misfit. He is merely an abstraction to her. Okay? By the end of the story, the situation will have reversed itself. And we will move from the abstract to the concrete and have the misfit totally in charge of the grandmother. Okay? For a while. Now, I'm just going to do the second, I'm going to do the second paragraph quickly. This is O'Connor at, well, I can't praise her sufficiently. Bailey didn't look up from his reading, so she wheeled around then and faced the children's mother, a young woman in slacks, whose face was as broad and innocent as a cabbage and was tied around with a green handkerchief that had two points on the top like a rabbit's ears. Bailey is leaned over the paper, and his face is probably orange. His wife has this face like a cabbage, green, with a green handkerchief and rabbit ears. We're getting comic strip stuff. We're getting cartoon stuff. These people don't have real lives. They're not real people. She is drawing us a cartoon. And I'll tell you one reason she's drawing a cartoon, because these people are not sufficiently human to be real. They are cartoons. They're comic strips. There's no blood in them. There's no life in them. There's no soul in them. And therefore, that's what we're getting. A quick comic sketch. All we learn about the mother, she doesn't have a name. And she is characterized totally by externals and just a couple of externals. She was sitting on the sofa feeding the baby his apricots out of a jar. I can't tell you why that's funny, but that's funny. The children had been to Florida before, the old lady said. You all ought to take them somewhere else for a change so they would see different parts of the world and be broad. They never have been to East Tennessee. Again, great comedy. The children's mother didn't seem to hear her, but the 8-year-old boy, John Wesley, a stocky child with glasses, said, "If you don't want to go to Florida, why don't you stay at home?" He and the little girl, June Starr, were reading the funny papers on the floor, preparing for their own lives, studying their catechism. Funny papers. They're going to grow up to be cartoons. They're already cartoons. John Wesley and June Starr. And they're bratty little children. So, we have the passive father, the mother who doesn't exist, the two bratty children, and the grandmother who's this awful old woman who's trying to run things. It's the ideal American family. There we have it. "She wouldn't stay at home to be queen for a day," June Starr said without raising her yellow head. We have the green-headed mother and the yellow-headed child. This is cartoon stuff, brightly colored as the comic papers. "Yes, and what would you do if this fellow, the misfit, caught you?" the grandmother asked. Joke, joke, joke. "Well, I'll use him as a club to beat my granddaughter with." "I'd smack his face," John Wesley said. "She wouldn't stay at home for $1 million," June Starr said, "afraid she'd miss something. She has to go everywhere we go." "All right, miss," the grandmother said. "Just remember that the next time you want me to curl your hair." June Starr said her hair was naturally curly. This is nightmarish stuff. This is real. It's funny, but it's nightmarish, and it's going, you know. She's tapped into something. This is realism. But by going cartoonish, she's hitting realism. Her cartoonish presentation is more real than reality. Now, a couple of quick things. We pack up. We're heading off. She hides the cat. She's willful. She's going to take her cat with her. She can't tell her son. She knows the son won't let her take the cat in the car. And the reason is, she didn't intend for the cat to be left alone in the house for 3 days because he would miss her too much, putting human feelings on the cat. And suddenly we're realizing the only love there is between the grandmother and her cat, because there's none coming from the family around her. This starts to hurt. It's understandable. It's Americans and their pets. Again, because of the world we live in. And she was afraid he might brush against one of the gas burners and accidentally asphyxiate himself. It is very funny, but notice what's happening. There is a chance of death for the cat if he's left home alone. Therefore, we can't leave the cat home alone. Death would come to the cat. Now, as a cat owner, I often have similar thoughts. So I don't mean to look down on the grandmother, but the point is this. The real death and danger is outside. It's not that the cat's going to asphyxiate itself at home. Her son, Bailey, didn't like to arrive at a motel with a cat. It's an embarrassment. It's bad enough traveling with the family, much less having to stop and try to get a cat into the motel. Now, we get a moment of genuine concern, a moment of genuine fear for the loss of a creature. It's the cat. We have a moment at the end, two paragraphs on. I'm not going to go through this. She dresses very nicely. Very nicely. The reason, the end of that paragraph that begins, the old lady settled herself comfortably. Last sentence. I'm not going to go through how she's dressed. It's very funny. It's very proper. She is proper. In case of an accident, anyone seeing her dead on the highway would know at once that she was a lady. This is riotously funny. But of course, what O'Connor is not telling us yet, there's a big thing missing, okay? The soul. What about the state of her soul? Doesn't give it a thought. What's important is, car accident, dead on the highway, they'll walk by and look at the corpse and say, she was a lady. Because she had a little sprig of violets pinned onto the, okay? Externals? Materialism? Being a lady, which is defined solely in terms of appearance and externals. And that connects us with the title of the story now. A good man is hard to find. And that means someone apparently who's well-dressed. Someone who's a gentleman, as she is a lady. And when we meet the misfit, he's going to be the first gentleman in the story. By her own definition, she is going to meet a good man. Okay? That's where we're coming. I've got to skip over the car trip. Let's just say, you know, go through the details and mark them off. Playing games with little kids who don't want to play games and who are bratty and who get in fights. My favorite moment, and again, it's quintessential, is when they start kicking the father's seat. He's trying to drive with all this chaos in the car, and they're kicking him. She says he felt it in his kidneys. It's just funny stuff. It's funny stuff. And then where do we arrive? We arrive at Red Sam's Barbecue, the Tower, it's called, for barbecued sandwiches. We meet Red Sammy Butts. I love it. Signs all up and down the highway. Try Red Sammy's famous barbecue. None like famous Red Sammy's. Red Sam, the fat boy with the happy laugh. A veteran. Red Sammy's your man. When I teach this, I always ask my students who are from the South to describe the local barbecue joint, and they always give me something just like Red Sam. I mean, this is real. This is absolutely real. Red Sammy was lying on the bare ground outside the tower with his head under a truck while a gray monkey about a foot high chained to a small chinaberry tree chattered nearby. You'll notice we've got the machinery and we've got those simians. There are monkeys and apes all the way through her stories because she knew that's what man was worshiping and descending into. They keep appearing over and over and over again. There they are. We kept this meaningless chatter with Red Sam and his wife. Whew, riotously funny. You can't win, he said. You can't win. And he wiped his sweating red face off with a gray handkerchief. These days you don't know who to trust, he said. Ain't that the truth? People are certainly not nice like they used to be, said the grandmother. And there it is. There it is again. As I said, the new modern Ten Commandments, thou shalt be nice, thou shalt be nice, thou shalt be nice, thou shalt dress properly and wear a little sprig of violets. And okay, so when you're found dead on the road, the people will be nice and say, she was nice. And, you know, it's your mother's had to say, you wear clean underwear and socks, because if you're in an accident, you don't want somebody to spy. I'm not going to have your body found with holes in the sock. Okay, be nice, be clean, be respectful. Okay, there's a whole area being left out here. And we know what it is. And she's deliberately leaving it out because it plays no part in modern American life. None. None. Except maybe if you go to church on Sunday. And then maybe that should be nice too. And grandma has a nice little cry and wipes the tears with her handkerchief and then goes home and is just impossible to live with. Okay? And the son probably doesn't go. And the kids go to the Sunday school and throw pictures of a Jesus puzzle at each other, and you know, it's horrifying. Okay, so and of course the grandmother's nice, and Red Sam is nice. He talks about it. Two men came in. I let them fellers charge the gas they bought. Now why did I do that? Because you're a good man, the grand, and we fortify each other. You're a good man, the grandma. And he, oh, yeah, well, yes, am I supposed to? Yes, I am a good man. Just as you're a real lady. Well, thank you. It is external politeness that has no meaning on earth. No meaning on earth. And then they talk about that criminal, the misfit, roaming around. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he didn't attack this place right here, said the woman. If he hears about it being here, I wouldn't be none surprised to see him. If he hears it's 2 cents in the cash register, I wouldn't be at all surprised. That'll do, Red Sam said. Oh, we got an unpleasant thing to talk about. Go on, talk about that. But please notice, he could show up here, he could attack this place, and if he does, he'll be after those 2 cents. He'll be after the money. When we meet the misfit, money is the last thing on his mind. He's not a robber. He's not out there doing what he does for material gain. The misfit is not a misfit because... he's a misfit because he's not interested in materialism. He's a misfit because the politeness in him runs deep. According to them, he is a good man. He's a misfit because he's got metaphysics on his mind. Okay? He's a misfit because he's asking philosophical questions in this vacuous, empty, dead world that she's presenting at the beginning of the story. I'll give you my favorite example. This is a conversation we get in one paragraph between Red Sam and the grandmother. Bottom of page 122 in this version. Paragraph begins, he and the grandmother discussed better times. The old lady said that in her opinion, Europe was entirely to blame for the way things were now. She said the way Europe acted, you would think we were made of money. And Red Sam, it was no use talking about it. She was exactly right. We now have a political discussion. We have a political discussion about the problems of the modern world in which America finds itself. And Europe's to blame. That's right. Europe's to blame because they think we're made of money. And there's no use talking about that. It's just the way it is. These people vote. These people are allowed to vote. It's wildly funny. The point is, they have no clue at all. Materialism, again, you'll notice. Just materialism. Europe thinks we're made of money. What's the problem? I'll tell you what the problem is. You want to get to the root of the problem? Here's the root of the problem. The root of the problem is Europe. What? Abstract gobbledygook. Abstract gobbledygook. Look the rest of the paragraph. The children ran outside into the white sunlight and looked at the monkey in the lacy chinaberry tree. He was busy catching fleas on himself and biting each one carefully between his teeth as if it were a delicacy. Why is all that in the same paragraph? For this very important reason. The grandma and Red Sam have a conversation. They exchange little flea bites of information. Here, try one of my fleas. Oh, that's lovely. Now try my little flea about my commentary on Europe, thank you. Oh, you're exactly right. And outside, the monkey's doing the same thing, picking the fleas off himself. And them fleas are good. It is a reduction of the human to the animal state. And the animal simply delighted with its own vermin. It's very funny. It's awful. It's awful. Off they head on the road again. Off they head on the road. And indeed, she decides willfully again she's going to go see that house that she hasn't seen in a while, okay? The point being, she doesn't know where she's going. And out of her ignorance and willfulness, she leads her family down the wrong road. Grandma's in charge. Bailey grumbles a bit, but there is no masculine energy in that car. There's no father. There's no vision. He's just getting kicked in the kidneys and grumbling. So Grandma leads the way, and Grandma doesn't have a clue. And down the wrong road we go. And then, what has Grandma smuggled into the car? An animal. And the animal gets loose. And right onto Bailey's shoulder. And whoa! Over goes the car rolling, and down into the ditch they go. And the children do what? Scream in joy. We've had an accident! We've had an accident! It's not just that they're bratty. It is another recognition of the absolute empty state of modern life that a disaster can be exciting because at least something has happened. For a moment, we're lifted out of the vacuity and the emptiness and the dread and the sludge, and something exciting has happened. We've had an accident! The children screamed in a frenzy of delight. But nobody's killed, June Star said with disappointment. Now, it's riotously funny, except second time you read through the story, the irony just hangs over it. Nobody's killed. You all will be, momentarily. And the blood runs cold. She does it again. Ooh. It's riotously funny. It's not funny at all. And it's those two things at once. Only a master artist could get away with it. They're all shaking. Maybe a car will come along. The car comes along. I'm racing through this because I need to get to the end. The driver got out of the car and stood by the side of it looking down at them. Notice the position. He is superior to them. They're in a ditch. Okay? They're injured, helpless, in a ditch. And there's truth in that. I mean, the action has brought them, in a sense, to where they are, to where they've been from the beginning. The first vision of them in the living room, they were injured, helpless, and in a ditch. They just didn't know it then. Now they're aware of it. The driver gets out, looked down at them. He was an older man than the other two. His hair was just beginning to gray, and he wore silver-rimmed spectacles that gave him a scholarly look. This is the first time thought has entered this story at all. He had a long, creased face and didn't have on any shirt or undershirt. He had on blue jeans that were too tight for him and was holding a black hat and a gun. The two boys also had guns. We've had an accident, the children screamed. The grandmother had the peculiar feeling that the bespectacled man was someone she knew. His face was as familiar to her as if she had known him all her life, but she could not recall who he was. He moved away from the car and began to come down the embankment, placing his feet carefully so that he wouldn't slip. He had on tan and white shoes and no socks, and his ankles were red and thin. Good afternoon, he said. I see you all had you a little spill. Good afternoon. He's very polite. Thank heavens he's come along. Thank heavens a polite young man has come along to help. I see you all had you a little spill. We turned over twice, said the grandmother. Once it be corrected. He's a truth teller. We seen it happen. Excuse me, ma'am. I watched it. Don't lie. You tell the truth. So, he's polite. He's a truth teller. We're meeting this good man. By all external signs, we're meeting this good man. That's so hard to find these days. We seen it happen. Try their car and see. Will it run, Hiram? He said quietly to the boy with the gray hat. He's going to help. He's here to help. What you got that gun for, John Wesley asked. What you going to do with that gun? Lady, the man said to the children's mother, Would you mind calling them children to sit down by you? Children make me nervous. I want you all to sit right down right together there where you're at. We have order. We have a man who's willing to express his inner feelings. Behind them, the line of woods gaped like a dark open mouth. Whenever you read O'Connor, always look at the horizons. There's always a dark line on the horizon, okay? Point being, there's always an end point. It's often dark. Look here now, Bailey began saying, we're in a predicament. We're in. The grandmother shrieked. She scrambled to her feet and stood staring. You're the misfit, she said. I recognized you at once. Yes'm, the man said, smiling slightly, as if he were pleased in spite of himself to be known. But it would have been better for all of you, lady, if you hadn't have recognized me. We have two truth-tellers. The grandmother just spoke her mind, as she always does. Bailey turned his head sharply and said something to his mother that shocked even the children. The old lady began to cry, and the misfit reddened. He's not used to hearing such language, and he's embarrassed for the older lady. This is a real gentleman. Now, she begins trying to correct the situation by talking about what? His good blood. Listen, I know you're a good man. You don't look a bit like you have common blood. I know you must come from nice people. Yes, ma'am, he said. Finest people in the world. When he smiled, he showed a row of strong white teeth. He's taken good care of his teeth. Every mother would love him. He brushes regularly. God never made a finer woman than my mother, and my daddy's heart was pure gold, he said. Watch them children, Bobby Lee. You know they make me nervous. Oh. Why don't you really just read the story? I mean, I'm just reading the story, giving commentary. The story is so brilliant. Once you catch on to it, it explains itself. It simply explains itself. I'm going to jump ahead. The first moment. Going to fix the car. Well, first you and Bobby Lee get him and the little boy to step over yonder with you. The boys wanted to ask you something. He said, would you mind stepping back in them woods there with them? Would you mind? He is very polite. They know where they're going. Listen, Bailey began. We're in a terrible predicament. Nobody realized what this is. His voice cracked. His eyes were as blue and intense as the parrots on his shirt. He's wearing this grotesque shirt, again with what? Parrots. Animals. Just spouting back what the world gives you. Just being part of that world and saying what you're supposed to say. But, of course, what we're facing now is the fact of death. Real death in a real world, and all of a sudden, the comic book and the comic section and the sports page and all the problems are just swept away. This is real life. This is what it's about. I've got to tell you, this stuff is overwhelming. I'll look at it. Hiram pulled Bailey up by the arm as if he were assisting an old man. John Wesley caught hold of his father's hand, and Bobby Lee followed. The son takes his father. For an instant, what are they? Father and son. And the boy's not smarting off. And the boy is dependent on his father and clinging to his father. Breaks your heart. The instant death is recognized, we have a family coming together. We have a father and son for the first time. They went off towards the woods, and just as they reached the dark edge, Bailey turned and, supporting himself against a gray naked pine trunk, he shouted, I'll be back in a minute, Mama. Wait on me. Breaks your heart. Breaks your heart. His last words, words of kindness to his mother. Bailey, boy, the grandmother called in a tragic voice, but she found she was looking at the misfit squatting on the ground in front of her. I just know you're a good man, she said desperately. You're not a bit common. All she knows how to do is flatter him. And her definition of a good man should be enough, meaning good people don't behave this way. But we're in an entirely different realm now. Her definitions are wrong, inadequate, have nothing to do with real life. Know him, I ain't a good man. The misfit said after a second, as if he had considered her statement carefully. She's spouting cliche, and he has intelligence, and he considers it. Well, no. No, I'm not good. But I ain't the worst in the world, neither. My daddy said I was a different breed of dog from my brothers and sisters. You know, daddy says, it's some that can live their whole life out without asking about it. And it's others has to know why it is. And this boy is one of the latter. He's going to be into everything. Now, the vision of the misfit's father is what you want are children who don't ask any questions, who just live their life, never analyze anything, because that's fine. That's the way life should be lived. What you have is a model of Bailey. What you have is another empty family. You just live. You just live. You don't question anything. You don't ask. You just live. You just get along. You just be nice. You start asking questions, oh, there's trouble, and then you get into everything. Next thing he said, I'm sorry I don't have on a shirt before you ladies. We buried our clothes the way out on when we escaped, and we're just making do until we can get better. We borrowed these from some folks we met. Oh! That's perfectly all right, the grandmother said. Maybe Bailey has an extra shirt in his suitcase. And then, of course, they bring her son's shirt out of the woods. He puts on her son's shirt. The parrots, okay? Now, she said, you could be honest, too, if you'd only try. She's giving a message. Think how wonderful it would be to settle down and live a comfortable life and not have to think about somebody chasing you all the time. The misfit kept scratching in the ground with the butt of his gun as if he were thinking about it. He contemplates everything everybody says to him. Yes, and somebody is always after you, he murmured. Do you ever pray, she asked. Know him. There was a pistol shot from the woods, followed closely by another. Then silence. The old lady's head jerked around. She could hear the wind move through the treetops like a long, satisfied insuck of breath. Bailey boy, she called. Breaks your heart. Comedy, tragedy, just... And she's flipping back and forth, sentence by sentence. These people, the world they live in, is in a joke. Boom! But they're human, and you ache for them. In their emptiness and their stupidity, as they are now going down to death. Now, he runs through his life for her. And suddenly, the grandmother just begins, pray, pray, the woman began, pray, pray. He says, but he wound up in the penitentiary, and he's not sure. But they said what I had done was kill my daddy, but I know that for a lie. My daddy died in 1919 of the epidemic flu, and I never had a thing to do with it. He was buried in the Mount Hopewell Baptist Churchyard, and you can go there and see for yourself. If you would pray, the old lady said, Jesus would help you. That's right, the misfit said. Well, then, why don't you pray? She asked, trembling with delight suddenly. She thought she's hooked onto something. She's got him. Okay? She's tried all the other cliches. So she finally pulls this out of her bag of tricks, and ooh, maybe this will work. I don't want no help, he says. I'm doing all right by myself. At which point he puts on the shirt. And then we get... Lady, he asked, would you and that little girl like to step off yonder with Bobby Lee and Hiram and join your husband? Yes, thank you, the mother said faintly. They're all so polite. These are the nicest people on earth. Her left arm dangled helplessly, and she was holding the baby who had gone to sleep in the other. Help that lady up, Hiram, the misfit said as she struggled to climb out of the ditch. And Bobby Lee, you hold on to that little girl's hand. I don't want to hold hands with him, June Star said. He reminds me of a pig. She remains true to herself. She remains the willful little girl. The fat boy blushed and laughed and caught her by the arm and pulled her off into the woods after Hiram and her mother. We got mass murder. I mean, we got this nice little story of a comic family journey turning into mass murder. Now, I want to make a point. This story was written in 1952. Mass murder was not a part of the American landscape in 1952. This story was a shocker when it was published and dismissed as so exaggerated and so grotesque that she had strained for effect. Every time I teach this story, I can count on within 1 week, one way or the other, there being a multiple shooting somewhere in the country. Always. It's never failed me yet. What we have this time, of course, is the airline being blown up with 210 people aboard and the two who were killed at the bombing at the Olympics last Saturday and along with the other 100 injured. So, you know, if we just within the last two weeks before I come here to teach you this, we have 314. Okay? People who were going about their business thinking life was fine and nothing mattered and being nice to each other, who are now either dead or injured. That wasn't happening in 1952. My point is, this woman knew this was about to start occurring. This story is essentially now a fact of American life. It's a typical Saturday morning and the kids wake you up and they're bratty and you get them dressed and you go to McDonald's and you're having a happy meal and you're watching the Ronald McDonald clown and you're drinking your McShake and eating your Egg McMuffin, and in comes some guy with a rifle and blows away 24 people. That's America. And you know what? That won't even make the front page anymore. It's so common. And the fact of the matter, and she knew it, sentimental, gooey niceness and violence are intimately connected. And the nicer America gets, the sweeter America gets, the kinder and gentler, the emptier America gets, and the more it denies real human nature, which has to do with the soul, which has to do with God, which has to do with truth, which has to do with four last things, okay? The more we deny that, the more anger grows in some souls that somehow knows there's more to life than a happy meal and the hills being alive and watching to see who's going to win the gold medal. That is not sufficient, and that's not why we're here. And here it goes. The misfit is a misfit because he is concerned with religious questions. Jesus, Jesus, she said, meaning Jesus will help you, but the way she was saying it, it sounded as if she might be cursing. Yes'm, the misfit said. Jesus thrown everything off balance. It was the same case with him as with me, except he hadn't committed any crime, and they could prove I had committed one because they had the papers on me. Of course, they never shown me my papers. That's why I signed myself now. I said long ago, you get you a signature and sign everything you do and keep a copy of it. Then you'll know what you done and you can hold up the crime to the punishment and see do they match. And in the end, you'll have something to prove you ain't been treated right. I call myself the misfit, he said, because I can't make what all I done wrong fit what all I gone through in punishment. I'm being punished. I haven't done that much wrong. Therefore, I'm going to go out and do wrong and balance the punishment. Well, let's take it on the simplest level. What is the ultimate punishment? It's death. It's punishment for the fall. And if you've got a whole country out there running around feeling it's sinless, it has no original sin, it's never done anything, then why should it die? And it's desperately trying to jog its way to eternal life, or having a pacemaker put in to pacemake its way to eternal life, or somehow grab a hold, because death isn't right. But you know what? Everyone jogging will die. All those pacemakers will stop. All of us in this room will one day be dead. And you've got some minds out there saying, why? Why? And you ask the question, you're the misfit. You're not supposed to ask that question. You're supposed to just watch TV, go to McDonald's, get a new car, okay? Don't ask that question, says America. And Flannery O'Connor says, okay, you can try to avoid asking the question, but somebody out there is going to ask it. And if you don't have the right answer to the question, look out, because that person's going to run wild. There was a piercing scream from the woods, followed closely by a pistol report. Does it seem right to you, lady, that one is punished a heap and another ain't punished at all? And there it is. I've been punished. I just punished your daughter-in-law. It's balance now. Jesus, the old lady cried, you've got good blood. I know you wouldn't shoot a lady. I know you come from nice people. Pray, Jesus, you ought not to shoot a lady. I'll give you all the money I've got. Just pathetic. But please notice, she is the woman she's always been. She's not shedding tears for her son and daughter-in-law and two grandchildren, for three grandchildren who are now dead. What's she thinking about? Herself, 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 herself. Lady, the misfit said, looking beyond her far into the woods, there never was a body that give the undertaker a tip. I don't care about money, he says. I'm thinking about death. There were two more pistol reports, and the grandmother raised her head like a parched old turkey hen crying for water and called, Bailey boy, Bailey boy, as if her heart would break. First moment of recognition. Breaks out of the self, finally, and cries for her dead son. Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead, the misfit continued, and he shouldn't have done it. He's thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure but meanness, he said, and his voice had become almost a snarl. We've got to credit the misfit. He knows your whole life and the way you live depends on one thing: whether or not Christ existed, was who he claimed to be, and did what he actually is reported to have done. And if it's true, then you better follow him. And if it's not true, life is without meaning and you might as well just do whatever and enjoy yourself. But notice, enjoyment comes through meanness, because if it's not true, there's no reason, there's no purpose, there's no order, there's no God, there's nothing, and that could make a person mad. Real angry. Maybe he didn't raise the dead, the old lady mumbled, not knowing what she was saying, and feeling so dizzy that she sank down in the ditch with her legs twisted under her. Now notice, suddenly she's discussing something seriously. She's taken the wrong tack, but she's engaged in an actual conversation. Second moment. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wished I had have been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice, if I had have been there, then I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. We have the young, thoughtful man asking the right questions, hence becoming a misfit, making the wrong decision, and hence filled with anger and lashing out at the world, but sadly thinking the only way you can know the truth of Christ is scientifically. If I had been there, I could have seen with my own eyes, and then I'd believe. But I wasn't there, so how can I know so? And it fills him with rage again. His voice seemed to crack. And the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. It's the most important sentence in the whole story. Step three. This head that's been filled with fog and nonsense her whole life cleared for an instant. Well, if one's head clears for an instant, there's only one place that clarity can come from. And that's from God. God's grace for one instant fills the head of this old woman. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." It is a moment of human contact, and she takes him under her love. She loves him. And for an instant, treats him better than she ever treated her own children. For an instant, she sees someone else's pain outside of herself, understands it, and feels human sympathy. She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. And it is a moment of charity. It is a moment of unusual, extraordinary, illogical charity, because she expresses love for the man who just killed her whole family. It is a moment of forgiveness and love. Now, the misfit had already made up his mind, such things cannot exist in the world. There is no Christ. It is not possible to forgive those who persecute you and harm you and make you suffer. That's not possible. He said that is not possible. So the moment she says, you're one of my own children, you're one of my own babies, and reaches out and touches him, it's the most horrifying thing that's ever happened to him, because it is proof, visual proof, what he had been calling for, that Christ must have lived, said what he said, did what he did, and raised the dead. And the misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her 3 times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them. And what's happening? He's going to see more clearly all of a sudden. But he has responded to forgiveness and charity the way that the world responds to it. You can't deal with it. Kill it. Get it out of there. Clear it out of the way. Hiram and Bobby Lee returned from the woods and stood over the ditch looking down at the grandmother, who half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's, and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. We might call it a good death, certainly better than anything in her life. Without his glasses, the misfit's eyes were red-rimmed and pale and defenseless-looking. Take her off and throw her where you've thrown the others, he said, picking up the cat that was rubbing itself against his leg. He's kind animal. She was a talker, wasn't she, Bobby Lee said, sliding down the ditch with a yodel. She would have been a good woman, the misfit said, if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. It's funny. Point being, the awareness of death can keep us honest and good, but only with the recognition that there is judgment afterward. That's the only thing that can give meaning, is the truth of Jesus raising the dead. Some fun, Bobby Lee said. Shut up, Bobby Lee, the misfit said. It's no real pleasure in life. Just 3 pages before, he'd said, no real pleasure in life but meanness. He has lost the pleasure of meanness. Why? He just had before his eyes the possible visible proof of something that goes beyond time, that goes beyond reason, that goes beyond his understanding of the world. There may be something more. And the fun has gone out of being mean. Story stops, because it's the grandmother's story, not his. Ends there. One could do a sequel, and I think one could project pretty easily what it would be. I remember being in Philadelphia at the time of a famous trial that went on. A cop had been chasing a young black man who had broken into a store window and stolen something, tackled the kid, they were wrestling. The cop had pulled his gun out to fire a warning shot. During the fight, the gun went off. The boy died. Huge, huge anger in the black community. Trial that on TV for weeks. The community calling for a death sentence for the cop. It was ugly. I remember watching the afternoon the verdict came in. The jury found the cop not guilty. And there were, riots outside the courtroom, but the courtroom cleared, and the cop was standing there, and the mother of the young black man walked down the aisle up to the policeman and kissed him on the cheek. Now, explain that other than through a divine love. It is not part of the logic of the world given human nature. And that is the moment of what the grandmother does to the misfit. And in this story, we again have just a hint of light, but the light is there, and the light is real. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. But the light is there. And once again, what you have here is an artistic genius who knew her time, who was a brutal truth teller. But in this particular story written in 1952, I would also say, was touched with a bit of the prophet. Because this is the America we're now living in, and she saw it coming. And the response to it can only be the response that's here. And it is the response of Christ as they hauled him through the streets to crucify him. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.